And you know, it's my baby, so I've always been looking after it. And so, strange thing, this year I'm the treasurer. Some mug on that has to do it. Weird as it might sound. But so we just had a teleconference, you know, with the monks in Queensland, Canberra, and Victoria, New South Wales, to work for Buddhism in the whole country. So that's the first Monday every month in the evening. So that was just went on to a few minutes ago. So I didn't fall asleep. I wasn't in jhana, unfortunately. I was just messing around with the sangha, which is very nice. It's actually quite inspiring to see that you are bringing together the monks, the nuns. There was one Vietnamese nun there because she was speaking very Vietnamese-y. And there's Sri Lankan monks. And who else was there? The Vietnamese monks, Thich Phuoc Thanh, and a few others in Queensland, Tibetan nuns in Queensland. So it's nice to get people all together, working together. A Zen monk as well. So anyway, the question's here. I remember you saying a couple of times in a retreat that your stomach tummy ache resolved in meditation and loving kindness. I heard your story before and tried loving kindness, and that worked every time. I did that when I had tummy ache. Even when my son had that same problem, I tried this and his pain went away every time I did that. Also, when I was meditating here twice, an Ajahn fly came to visit. In other words, a fly came in. I kindly said, may you be happy and well somewhere else. Not too close to me, please. And the fly went away. Obviously, I heard this from you before with metta. So it works. So if everybody do this, people like Mukta would have no job. She's a doctor. But it actually works. It's amazing. The healing power of meditation. So one of the great stories of, so many of them. One of the nicest stories of healing through meditation was on one of the retreats in Sydney I did some years ago. And there, the first night question time was, can you please tell people to breathe quietly in the hall? Because this one gentleman was breathing so loudly. And I replied that that gentleman has a huge tumor in his sinus. He's dying. And he's come to this retreat as a last throw of the dice because his doctors have given up all hope. And that's the only way he can breathe, through his mouth. He's got this big lump of tumor in his sinuses. And of course, after that, no one complained. Just imagine how kindness, you know, overcomes this fault-finding mind. You think, oh, poor thing, he's dying. And so that didn't disturb anybody afterwards. Same noise, but different attitude. But the nice thing was that throughout the whole retreat, he was breathing through his mouth and getting nowhere. He didn't have the interviews, but just on the last meditation, I don't know why it's the last meditation, maybe it's because he gave up, he let go. But he came and saw me before I left and said, Ajahn Brahm, amazing thing happened. I was meditating as usual, just through my mouth, and I heard a pop. I remember the way he described it, a pop, and he could breathe through his nose. But only for about a couple of minutes, and then the tumor closed up again. But he said, I could actually breathe for 2 minutes. It was amazing. And what that did, it gave him hope that something was happening. And personally, I thought he left it too late. He's going to die. But these amazing stories have happy endings. I was teaching in Sydney somewhere else about a year later, and this guy came up and asked a question, please never ask this of me. Do you remember me? Look, I meet thousands of people. I'm just in Indonesia, get 3,500, 2,500 in every talk. And you say that, I come from Medan, I was in your talk 3 years ago, do you remember me? And there's 5,000 other people there. But anyway, he said, do you remember me? And of course I said, I'm honest, I offend people, I'm sorry about that, but I don't remember you. And he said, I was that guy. you know, his beating heart, who had the tumour in his sinuses. That one pop just gave me courage and confidence to carry on, and the tumour went into full remission. It's gone, totally gone, through the meditation. And he said, I'm spending the rest of my life, you know, a gift, of teaching other people how to meditate. So he just came up to say hello, thank you. That's amazing that this happens. Many, many people like that. The power of this meditation, of kindness, you know, letting things be, relaxing. Oh, it's amazing how powerful that is. And that's the real case of a guy with a huge tumour in his nose, couldn't breathe, and gone, and having a nice life now. Dear Ajahn, saw your cave today. I think it's the best real estate in town. So how much are you going to offer? Best real estate in town. Any chance of renting it to a layperson for a week or two? Yes, I will rent it to you. And the cost is your hair. You have to ordain. That's the only way you can get into my cave. Thank you for letting to have a glimpse of your accommodation. Yeah, it's very nice because it's set up as a meditation cave of simplicity. Quiet, dark, but it's got enough air flowing through. If you saw the vents there, there's always a very slight flow of air just to keep it fresh. And when you're inside anyway, you're just breathing very gently, so you don't use much air. It's really, 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 really nice. And they also told me that those granite rocks, which are from the scarp here, that they've got, they're very slightly radioactive. So if you stay in there long enough, that's where you get your nimitus from. You're radioactive. You are a mutant monk. Okay, I read a book of Pra Ajahn Kamdi Pabaso. What means by actual unawareness is aware. But there's one thing it's not aware of, itself. It's like the eye. The eye can see everything except for itself. Of course you can see your eye, just look in the mirror. The eye can see everything except for itself. If we didn't have inventions like mirrors, you'd have no hope of ever seeing your own eyes, your own face. Of course you can have out-of-body experiences, get outside and see it, sit in water, whatever. Anyway, don't know what's he up to. Seeing your own eyes, your own face. The reason we can see our face is because of mirrors. The same holds true with the awareness of the mind. I suppose so. In the suttas there is Ananda's, where he became a stream winner. He was looking at his reflection in a mirror or in the water. And what was it? The simile of the mirror. That all ideas of a self are reflections of one or more of the five khandhas. And understanding these five khandhas are impermanent, subject to cessation. And one day they'll all finish off. He realized that there's nothing permanent here in the sense of self. There's no permanent either. And so that was his mirror reflection. But anyway, I'm not quite sure what the question is, so if I didn't get it, please ask it again. Just as a ball will naturally roll down a hill, cause and effect, is it true to say that the busyness of life causes the proverbial leaf of the mind to constantly flutter? Yes. You seem like a busy person. Oh, yes, you bet. How do you deal with business in life meditation? Is it possible to be busy and have stillness within? Now, it's one of the quotes which was in one of those little books. A busy person is someone who does too many things at the same time. You look busy because you're doing so many things. So a successful person, you can just get lots of things done. But they just do one thing at a time. They don't even look busy, which is why you don't get so stressed out. So a lot of stress is doing too many things at the same time. And you get far more efficiency. Just do one thing, do it well, focus on it, and leave the next thing till later. Then you get much more done because you're efficient. And you don't get so stressed out. You don't get pulled in so many directions. You can focus on just the one thing at hand. So that's actually what you learn when you meditate, just to focus on one thing. Past, future, gone. Just focus on the task at hand. Give that everything you've got. When it's finished, you've done a good job. You don't have to go back again fixing up mistakes because you haven't been paying full attention. So that's the way to get more things done in life with less work. Great. And basic earn of value, you know, all the jobs which I have to do. Whew. So, you know, lots and lots of different roles you have to play and lots of stuff. So, I do remember that time in Singapore. I was giving a talk in Harbourfront in the World Trade Center pavilion over there. And this question time, someone went to the microphone. This is funny. And they said, it's all right for you to talk like this, but you don't know what real life is. You're a monk. You have a nice, easy life. You don't have to have the stress which we lay people have. And, you know, it's a challenge. And I thought, you know, I can be quite sort of cheeky and assertive. I'm not going to stand for that. So I got on the microphone and said, listen, fellow, this is what I've been doing. You get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I forget what exactly what I was doing. I listed all the things I'd done that day without any rest. And it was about 10 o'clock at night. I hadn't stopped. Now, talking about something, asking questions, counseling people, going to visit someone in a hospital, the usual stuff you have to do because you're only there for a short time. And even the meal is not lunch like you have it. Now, you have lunch and people talk to you, and afterwards they talk about their suicide or their marriage problems. There's no such thing as a free lunch for a monk. So anyway, there you go. And so I said everything I'd done until about 10 p.m. that night. And then this guy came on the microphone again and said, wow, I never realized how hard a monk has to work. You know, before I listened to you, I thought I would become a monk one day, but not now. I lost one. So, but anyway, that's how you can sort of, you know, and also lots of laughter. Don't take things seriously. And one thing at a time. And that means you can get lots done without being too busy. Yesterday, I waited for 3 to 4 hours at Bodhinyana to meditate at your cave. But I found some shoes in there. Well, I thought she got into deep meditation, but later I opened the door. She was sleeping in there. Bad. Is it bad karma? No, because she was tired. So, wonderful. She had a beautiful sleep. So you say, oh, wonderful. Thank you. I got upset. You know, why are you getting upset? You should have lovely kindness. She had really nice sleep. Oh, isn't that wonderful? It's amazing. Fault finding. Oh, I wanted to meditate in there. You got upset because of your wanting and craving. Not because of her. She taught you a very good lesson. So whoever that was, you should go and bow to her and say, thank you, teacher. Thank you, Ajahn. Doesn't she realize that many people want to meditate in your cave? I know I should be kind and gentle and make peace. I should let go, but I can't. Then it's your problem. Not hers. Anyway, metta meditation is my weakness. Is there only one type of meditation to soften my heart? Is there, if there is ill will during my meditation, I can't overcome it. Should I carry on meditation or better stop it and do other things such as walk in the forest? No, you should do ill will meditation. Sit down, close your eyes, and think of this woman and think of all the things you're going to do to her when you find out who she is. Do ill will meditation. Really get into it. And then feel what you feel like. This rotten feeling. Really, it's just, you get energy, but it's nasty energy. And it wears you out afterwards. So I want you to do, ever do this, do ill will meditation for half an hour. It really hurts. And then because you do it, you're not trying to escape from it, you're actually focusing on it, you're learning what ill will is and how nasty it is. So deliberately, whoever wrote this, sit down half an hour, ill will meditation. And don't wander off into metta. Focus. See if you can do that. This is just reverse psychology. Yeah, it's amazing just how powerful that is. This is adapted from one of Ajahn Chah's little methods. Because when he went to England, somebody asked him, how do you deal with ill will? I'm always getting angry. And what he said, easy. sit down, get a clock like this out, put it in front of you, and see how long you'll be angry for. See if you can beat your record. Sit down there and really get angry, and see how many minutes you can be angry for. Because what that was actually doing, very skillful, what it was actually doing, because you're aware of the anger, not the person who you are focusing the anger on. The reason why we don't realize how much anger hurts, because we're not really feeling what it's doing to us. You're totally focused on that damn person who was in my cave, sleeping. That's what you're focusing on, her. And you're not realizing what you're doing to yourself. So by putting a clock there, getting angry, and just how long you're getting angry for, you actually, skillful means being aware of anger itself. Not the object of the anger, but the feeling of anger. And that's the same with what I was saying, meditate on ill will for half an hour. Don't meditate on that person, meditate on ill will. And then you really get to know just what you're doing to yourself. You're really hurting yourself, it's not worth it. The reason why people get angry is because they're not watching the anger, they're watching the person, the object of the anger, rather than the anger itself. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I've heard that one should not practice jhanas if the foundation of siddha is not solid. Please elaborate on this point. That is gomayan. So do the jhanas first and the siddha will come afterwards, the virtue will come afterwards. It's great if you have lots of virtue. And then you can get so deep and the deepness of meditation will make the virtue stronger and then the jhana will be, or the meditation gets stronger, the virtue stronger. They support one another. So you think, oh, you know, I can't do jhanas until I got virtue. How much virtue do you need to do jhanas? And actually, as I was saying, that just the more, the easier it is. But you can still do jhanas with not much virtue. You can, but it's difficult. The more virtue, the easier it is. So don't just go saying, I need to perfect my virtue before I do jhanas. No, don't do that. Do the virtue and the jhanas. Look, is this virtue? Well, look at me, okay. I told this story before. The first time I got very deep meditation was about 10 days after having sex with my girlfriend. Okay? So was I really virtuous? Well, I was committed to a one relationship, but, you know, it's not exactly being eight preceptor. I wasn't drinking. That was... Yeah, no, I'd given up drinking. But I wasn't a vegetarian yet. Was I? No, I wasn't a vegetarian. And I was reasonably okay, but not that virtuous. Just an ordinary student. And there you got this incredible meditation. So, can be done. But difficult. So, best do your precepts, do your meditation, do your precepts. Grow them together. Okay? Thank you to all, to Ajahn and the Jhana Grove Subcommittee and BSWA. Thank you to my friends and family for giving me the gift of silence and blissful kindness of being ignored. I'm so grateful. So you're being ignored. Amazing. Because when you're ignored, you're like a nobody. And you know this, when you're ignored, you're a nobody instead of being always a somebody. And being a nobody is great. Because haven't you heard, didn't I say this yesterday? Nobody is perfect. So if you're a nobody, you must be perfect. And also the other joke, nobody is better than God. So if you're a nobody, look how high you are. Dear Ajahn, I have no problems with the headmaster seeing the prostitute. Oh, that's right, that was the other day, yeah. I have a problem with the lack of care, respect and choice of those who are prostitutes. Fair enough, that's a good point. The judge fined people for letting the cassava potato seller go hungry. And who do we fine for allowing prostitution to become an option for women, mainly? I doubt that anyone's little daughter, when asked, what do you want to be when you grow up, says a prostitute. Do you hear what I read in the newspaper in Scandinavia? And other countries are following this. They're not making prostitution illegal. So the prostitute is not going to be punished or fined or anything. The one which is illegal is the guy who buys her service. That's illegal. So they're actually punishing the users of prostitutes. So if a guy goes with a prostitute, the prostitute doesn't commit a crime, but the guy does. So it puts the onus of the crime on the person who pays the prostitute money. And they say that makes a total difference to the whole idea of prostitution. It actually is working. Because, you know, they catch a guy with a prostitute. You know, in most jurisdictions, you know, the guy says, oh, it's a guy thing. You know, it was consensual, you paid for it. But the poor prostitute gets in trouble. You know, not paying taxes or whatever. And they get her for something or other. But no, in Scandinavian countries, you know, the prostitute's let off. No, nothing wrong. You can do that if she wants to, it's her free will. But the guy, you know, who actually buys her services, he's the one who's charged with the crime and gets fined or goes to jail. It's actually putting the onus on the other side. And it's actually working. Sometimes it's people have these brilliant ideas. I remember, for example, environment. The way they cleaned up the River Thames in London where I lived. Because I remember as a boy, I was born in 1951, as a boy, you go for a walk by the River Thames, and there were signs, I remember those signs, saying, if you fall in, here's a number, call the ambulance straight away to get your stomach pumped out. Because the water was that toxic when I was young. Now, you could swim in it, you could fish in it, it's really clean. It took a stinking, dirty, polluted river and turned it into a healthy one. And you know how they did that? It was such a simple legislation. The law was that every factory or business which took water from the river, that their inlet pipe had to be just a few meters downstream of their outlet pipe. So whatever the muck they put into the river, they were the first ones to get it back into their plant. It's so simple. And that was the law. And that one law cleaned up the River Thames. You know, whatever they did, they would get the consequence immediately. Karma. What they usually did, they took out the clean water upstream, the dirty water downstream for somebody else to worry about. But you know, they got the clean stuff. But now, whatever they put back in, they would get first. There's brilliant ideas. Or like, when I was a young monk in Thailand, in Ubon, you know, where Ajahn Chah's monastery was, there was not enough public toilets. So there was one wall, and everybody, all the taxi drivers and people who were too busy, that's where they would urinate. And it stank. And it was really unhealthy. So the government put the sort of the sign on there. So don't urinate. Yeah, of course, no one would bother about that. And it was still as bad. And then one government official had these beautiful ideas. And they said, Ti Pesawa Kong Ma. You know, you're laughing already. This is the place for dogs to piss. And that cleaned it up straight away. And so sometimes the signs are really good. So that's, you know, sometimes people just get the idea and things happen and change. So prostitution, what a brilliant law that is. Find the users. Prosecute them rather than the suppliers. Anyway, how to deal with emotional hardness in meditation. Be kind to it. Don't try and change it. You've got emotional hardness. I don't know why that is. So be kind to it. Because again, you can see what's happening if you're emotionally hard. I don't want to be emotionally hard. This is rotten. What happens? It gets harder and harder and harder and harder and harder. So let it be. Allow yourself to be emotionally hard for the rest of your life. And that is undermining the hardness. If that doesn't work, soak your head in water. That will soften it. Listen to a joke. Laugh. That softens the emotional hardness. That's sometimes some people, you know, I tell them jokes and you look at them and they don't, the first one, they want to laugh but they won't. The second one, and after a while they just burst out and they break down and I break them. There was the other one about, I wasn't going to tell this but now I'll tell it, about, I don't think I have told this yet, about the fellow who was, he had a little farm and all the people would drive really fast down this piece of road past his farm. And they speed, making a noise. It was really dangerous. So he asked his local council, can you put up a speed sign on this area because it's really disturbing? And the local council said, no, we can't do that. We've got to get permission from this and from that. You know, it's just too difficult. No, we won't do it. And so he said, okay. And he made his own sign, you know, 50 kilometers an hour. And then as soon as the council found out, you can't put up your own speed signs, that's against the law, so it took it down. And anyway, people weren't following that speed sign anyway. So he thought, what can I do? So he got this beautiful solution. This is like thinking outside the box. He put up another sign. And everyone slowed down. Problem solved. And the sign was, just on the start of his farm, nudist colony. All the men slowed down. So if you've got a busy street and people are like, put nudist house, and then everyone will slow down. Anyway, I shouldn't go there any further. I'm going to have another question tomorrow. I like the joke, but about nudist, that jumps up. Could you please explain what Wetakhamu Chara in Jhana are? The Thai translation is very confusing. Very good. Now, Wetakhamu Chara are a couple of the qualities of first jhana, and they're also used in other places. And the interesting thing is, in the Chinese translation of the suttas, they use different translations for the same word outside of jhana and in jhana. It's really, really good, because one word has many different meanings. When I sort of made the title of my first book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. You know what I mean about your heart, you know, your mind, this beautiful thing inside of you. But somebody did tell me they were looking for my book in a bookshop in Adelaide. And they looked for the usual section, you know, New Age, religion, self-help. They couldn't find it anywhere there. You know where they found it? In the medical section. Someone who was finding the book, Open the Door of Your Heart, medical, cardiac surgery. Because a word can have two different meanings in different contexts, and that's Wetakhamu Chara. So usually it does mean thinking. But in jhana, it doesn't mean thinking. It means the movement of the mind onto the object, the bliss. You know, the mind moves onto it. And because it holds it, that's the vichara, it's unstable and you move off again. It's what I call the wobble of the first jhana. But I'll say that more when we go into jhanas, another talk. But it does mean different things in different places. Dearest emptiestness, sometimes people ask me, what should we call you? And it was, for a long time, His Emptiness, I said, was my name. But these days, instead of His Emptiness, I prefer to be called His Roundness. His Roundness. Because sometimes people have these titles and they're just enhancing their ego. No, Your Holiness. Or sometimes people call me Father. Or what else do they call me? Your Enlightenedness or something, I don't know. But, you know, all these titles which people put on you, if you're not careful, you know, you'd actually believe some of this stuff. And you get proud and arrogant. Your Most Enlightenedness. You know, they have these days, if you don't call yourself venerable anymore, they call you Most Venerable. And Extreme Venerable. And the Mostest Extremist Venerable. And human nature even gets into the monasteries as well. So that's why I prefer, you know, getting titles which are more fun and more more putting yourself down. In other words, his roundness. It's a nice, funny title. And it's also, it's quite nice and warm and cuddly. So if you want to call me, write me a letter, email me, his roundness, Ajahn Brahm. When you talk to me, excuse me, your roundness. A monk once told me to find a teacher and stick to that teacher. Because if you have too many teachers, it's like a hall with many doors. It's great. We've got this door over here, the door over there, door over there. This is a brilliant hall because you can come out this way and that way and you can escape. What's wrong with many doors? It's like a hall with many doors. If you could enter from the main door, why would you want to waste time finding which other door to best get into the hall? Because if you see someone you don't like coming in one door, you can get out the other door quickly. It's really helpful. I look at it as having many teachers is a great idea. You have more options to learn different flavors than teachers from many teachers. What are your thoughts? Exactly, I agree with you. The more teachers, the better. Dear Ajahn, are the blind and deaf have less work to do to discover the emperor than ordinary people? Now, that is an interesting question. No, because if you lose one sense, you actually compensate on the other senses. And who was it? Somebody who had... I know who was deaf, and they gave them their sense of sound back, some sort of operation, they could hear again. And they complained and said, I wish you'd have given, no, they were blind, I think, they were blind, and somebody gave them their sight back, and they say, I didn't want to see things, I wish you'd have given me another hand. Because they explored the world through feeling, and for them the whole world of feeling was just so incredibly interesting and beautiful. And know, what you see seeing beautiful things, they would feel beautiful things. And that part of their brain was just so enhanced that they experienced an incredibly beautiful, wonderful world just through touch. And that had become so refined, they say, we don't want another eye, but I wish you'd have given me another hand. So I could even explore this world of tactile feelings and sensations more. It's a fascinating statement by somebody, you know, who said what it was like, you know, to have one sense which was so advanced because one of the other senses hadn't developed since birth. But is it easy to develop the emperor? Actually, no. Because even if you've only got three senses, those other senses are much, much stronger and harder to turn off. So, you know, if you can't see, but you can hear... Hearing is incredibly acute. You can hear things which other people can't hear. Or, you know, if you can't see and hear, maybe smell is like a dog. So you can smell so much. And those become very, very enhanced. And so it's very difficult to turn off smell for someone whose sense of smell is really, really strong. So my understanding is it's exactly the same. If you've lost one sense, the other four senses take up the slack. Well, it's very interesting to actually to know what happens to the human brain and mind, you know, when one sense is really, really developed. We really develop our sense of sight above all others. That's how we sort of recognize most of the things in the world. Hearing is maybe number two and feeling number three. We may differ than that, but smelling and taste is hardly developed at all. But, you know, like a dog, the smells that dogs have, they're incredible. Just, you know, they know everyone by their smell. Now, to me, if I smelled you and smelled you, I wouldn't know who you were. So, it's amazing, the senses. Anyway, your highest emptiness, see what I mean? Your highest, the most extreme highest. I saw you standing on one of the stupas day before yesterday. What was on your mind? How much have you accomplished? Nothing was on my mind, nothing I've accomplished. Ah, you've accomplished the great nothingness, the great emptiness. Oh, I'm so proud of you. But this is the problem was, I remember when I was at school, you know, maybe the first year, and the teacher said, what are you thinking? And I said, nothing. And I got into big trouble for that. You know, I could have been a natural meditator. I could have been enlightened at six. And they told me to think. So what's on your mind? Nothing. I was just enjoying myself. The first time I came to Jhana Grove in 2012 was the best experience of my life. Thank you so much. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It's all been downhill ever since. No, I made that up. They didn't say that. I enjoyed experiencing the forest by foot. It was like my own mini adventure. I even found the perfect spot to be alone, and it has the most gorgeous view of Jhana Grove. However, it seems it saddens me that the spot has been replaced by pavement now. Why can't we keep Jhana Grove as organic as it is and stop developing Jhana Grove? Feels like we are spoiling the essence of Jhana Grove. Thank you always, Ajahn. It's progress. You can't stop progress. One of the reasons why we have paths is so people don't fall over. Because sometimes in the forest, especially here, the gravel is called pea gravel. It's got little round balls. And sometimes, the, you know, people, they're walking, they're not that mindful. It's so easy to slip. It's one of the reasons why we put some paths in places, so you don't slip over. The concrete roads, that is for the fire trucks to prevent this place from burning down in the fire season. And if it's a path which is the gravel path, again, that is for fire breaks. And it's to protect the forest, not to destroy it. Because when it comes to the... There's no other dangers here. The kangaroos, you know, they're not sort of psychopaths. You know, they don't sort of go out and maul you in the middle of the night and eat you up. You know, there's nothing really which is dangerous here except the bushfires. And that's, you know, in usually January and February. And we've got to be really hyper-vigilant for those. And if there is a fire, a bushfire, as always is in Australia, you know, we need those roads to encourage the bushfire brigades to get in quickly and extinguish the fires. If it's natural, in other words, rocky, uneven, this is an emergency. This is where the bushfire brigade have accidents because they can't control the vehicle. And a lot of times they say, no, we can't go down because it's too dangerous. And so they have to let the thing burn. So this is actually to save the lives. No, the bushfire people, people who volunteer to save this place if there's a big fire. And also, you know, to protect it from fire. So that's the reason why it's there. And there's so much other natural land in Jhana Grove. It's 140 acres. That road is hardly an acre. It's probably a half an acre or a quarter of an acre. There's still plenty left. So don't look at the two concrete bricks. Look at the 998 sort of pieces of grass and rocks and uneven places. So that's why we have those bushfires, which is our big danger here. I have a weird experience. How great. I love weird experiences. See how weird this is. I have a weird experience while meditating, and it's been like this for a few months. And I'm afraid to meditate when someone is around in the hall. Wow, this is interesting. My head would naturally fall to one side when I sit in a chair, when I start meditating. After a while, my head starts to move in a clockwise position. Is that what it means, like round, round? Or does it mean like round, like in this way? Like in, there's a movie, I never saw it, but it's supposed to be Exorcist, like The Exorcist. It moves round and round. Is that what you mean, moving round in a clockwise direction? And keeps doing that until my head would bend forward with neck touching my chest. When it bends backwards, I feel like a rag doll who has lost my neck spine. As the neck keeps turning around and round for an hour, I am aware of what's going on and sometimes scared because I can't control what's happening. After a few times this happened, I got a bit used to it and at times would lose my thinking, which would lead to streaks of light flickering at the edges of my mind. I try to focus on one bright spot like you said yesterday, but once I do, the spot moves further away. So I just let it be as I'm chasing after and creating craving. Brilliant, well done. My question, how do I stop my thoughts of being afraid that people who walk past me might think I'm a lunatic? And is it normal to have experiences like this? "You're all lunatics. You're all..." Didn't people tell you this is not Jhana Grove? You may have forgot this is... You've been admitted to Jhana Grove Institution for the mentally unstable. Look at me. What do you think I'm doing in here? We just don't tell you, that's all. Now, honestly, you're not mentally unstable, just normal. Recently, my back started to follow my neck and rotate around clockwise until my chest touches my thigh while rotating. Once I nearly fell off the chair, but I'm aware. I have a back and neck issue all this time. Sorry, Ajahn, for the long letter. Thank you. Okay, now this is a nice question because it brings into mind about what's happening when you're meditating. Now, first of all, I'm not quite sure about that person, but you know, if you opened your eyes when you think, this I'm not quite sure, but this happens to many people, when you think you're rotating, you're perfectly straight and stable. Because there's this one lady, she said, "I was rocking so much when I was meditating, and I don't know how to stop it." And I think, "And I saw you weren't." She said, "Yes, I was." And so the next time, I actually kept my eyes open and watched her. She was perfectly still. And then afterwards, she said, "Did you see me? I was rocking all over the place." I said, "No, you were not. You were perfectly still. I watched you all that time." Because what happens sometimes, your perception, when you get to a certain part of meditation, really goes a bit strange. It's like you lost control of your perception. So you can perceive things in very weird and strange ways. That's a good sign in meditation. And sometimes you feel like you are rocking or twisting around. Sometimes you feel like your body's expanding or lifting up into the air. You have all those feelings. That is a stage of meditation. I call it when perception gets free and gets its wings. And you don't have to be afraid. It's good fun. You know, meditation can be very boring. You know, watching the breath go in, go out. But when you have these interesting little events happen, it's really cool. And I'm not afraid of weird stuff. And I mentioned when, you know, walls disappeared. Or one time when I had great meditation, I was passing by the washing line and I saw a black towel hanging on the washing line, perfectly black. And I stopped because I'd never seen one of those before. Yellow towels, pink towels, blue towels, white towels, but a jet black towel. And I stared at it for a couple of minutes and then it turned back to white again. Did someone put magic mushrooms in the curry this morning? What's going on? And afterwards I remember reading the sutras and yeah, this is how perception works. You've been trained and conditioned to see things in one particular way. And that conditioning, that control, is sometimes removed when you're meditating. And sometimes your body feels expanding, expanding, expanding. That happened to me once. I felt my body was expanding and expanding, expanding, just like the perception. And then I made a mistake, I opened my eyes. And it's been stuck like this ever since. Okay, that's a joke. I admit it, that's not true. But you do get these feelings of expanding, and many people have those. So number one, you know, if you opened your eyes and your head was on your thighs, fair enough. But you know, if when you opened your eyes you were back normal again, it's probably the case that this is just perception playing around, nothing else. You haven't moved at all. And if you get someone to take out your mobile phone and video you, you'd be shocked. I'm actually still, but I'm sure I was moving. Yes, that's what it feels like. You don't. It's just perception, just loosening off from your control. The next thing, sometimes people do move around. And if they do it, if it's that top part of meditation, you're about to see beautiful lights and stuff, that is actually brilliant stuff. Because this is where your body is healing itself. And the example I'd like to say, there was this lady once. These were the times we had the retreats in North Perth. And I was teaching a retreat there. And somebody asked me, "Please take a look at that girl." And I did, and she was contorted into meditation. Now, usually you try and tell what she was doing, but I can't do that. And you'd have to take me to hospital afterwards if I reproduced her position. She was really contorted. And I was really worried about her. You know, if you're in that sort of position, you know, you're going to have to go to hospital. You're really bent all over. And I waited for her to come out of meditation. She got out of meditation. She was smiling. I said, "How do you feel?" She said, "I feel great. I feel wonderful." I said, "Well, what's going on there?" "So, you know, you were really contorted while you were meditating." She said, "Really? Was I? I never knew that. I was just having a nice, peaceful time." And then it clicked. "Oh, you've had a car accident, have you?" "How did you know, Ajahn Brahm? I always expected you had psychic powers. Now I know." I said, "No, it's not psychic powers. It's just because, you know, you've injured your body very much. You must have done. Because your body, when you've been letting it go, and haven't been controlling it, it's basically disappeared from your consciousness, it's vanished. Then your body is actually twisting around. It knows, you don't know, how to put itself so you get some healing going in there." It was healing energies. And that's why you probably felt physically just so good. Aches, pains, which may have been there for months, not there. He said, "Yeah, exactly. This is what happens when you let go of the body. Sometimes it does move. It moves by itself because it needs to." So the person who asked this question, if you were rotating around, really rotating, not just perceiving it to be, your body needed to do that. Why it needs to do that to get healthy, I don't know, but just let it happen, because it's always really good. And then afterwards, it lasts for, you know, a few weeks, a couple of months, and then when the healing's all done, you know, it doesn't move anymore, it doesn't need to. I trust my body so much that if that's what it wants to do, I let it do it. There's always some healing somewhere, especially if you had some car accident, physical accidents, where the body's been just a bit mangled, and this is the way it deals with it. Really fascinating to see. "Today I begin to feel happy deep inside of me. I feel myself so lucky to be here on this retreat. Just enjoyed meditating, enjoyed listening to your talks, enjoyed the good food, the quietness and surrender to this space. Why should I expect anything more?" Exactly. "I think I begin to let my heart open to your kind advice. Thank you very much." You know what we chanted? I heard you chanting, you know, while I was just waiting to come in after my teleconference, about the Metta Sutta. What is it? Let none deceive another. Let them be not, contented and easily satisfied. Not proud and demanding in nature. Remember that for your meditation. Be contented and easily satisfied. Not demanding. I demand third jhana. If I don't get third jhana, I'm going to ask for my money back and I'm going to, you know, you promised all these things, I don't get it. I demand third jhana. That's, you know, sometimes people do that and they don't demand it of me, they demand it of themselves. Come on, get going. It's only a few days to go. Come on. Please be contented and easily satisfied. Oh, this is good enough for me. Just the food I got today, maybe not what you really would like. You wouldn't order that food, maybe, if you went to a restaurant, but it comes from all these beautiful, kind people who drive all the way from Perth to feed you. And they give the best food they could possibly give. That's one of the most beautiful parts of this Jhana Growth Retreat. Seeing all these people come, and they're giving you food. You can understand giving food to monks, maybe, that's tradition. But giving food to you, why is that? Because they respect meditation. And they also want the chance. They come here as well to meditate, and someone else feeds them. And that just really just opens your heart up when you see all these people. And they love doing this. They don't get paid. And they just love it. And you see how many people came today. Huge number of people. And how much fun they have. "How to deal with the headache, giddiness, light-headed feeling after meditation?" Oh, just get up slowly. Ajahn Chah used to say that sometimes you're so peaceful in meditation that if you get up too quickly, it's like putting hot water into a cool glass. Something cracks. So if you've got a cool glass, you've got to sort of make it warm slowly, thaw it out. So if you do get a deep meditation, don't jump up and do something else. Especially if it's just time for lunch. I'm going to miss all the best bits, and jump up. No, just get up slowly. Remember, just once in Nolamara Centre on a Saturday afternoon, 3 to 4:15. There's one guy, he got into very deep meditation. So he never came out after the 4:50, after 4 o'clock and the talks. And I could see what he was up to. And, he was up there till 5:30. He got into a jhana. And he got to really praise, one of the caretakers there, Lynn Jackson. I really thanked her. I said, well done, all these years you've really started to understand some of the things I've been teaching. She waited for him, waited half an hour and a half, for him to sort of open his eyes. And very gently, she led him into one of the side rooms to actually to slowly come out of a deep meditation. Because he needed just to slowly come out. Because if he come out too fast, it's just too hard. You're really, really cool, very, very soft, very sensitive. So he come out very, very slowly. Not too fast. So I just never thought that that Lynn was so smart, so much intelligence on how to help a person out of their first deep meditation. Anyway, Ajahn, you've been traveling a lot from country to country to teach. Have you ever gone hungry because of the time lapse between countries? Yeah, you go hungry, but mostly because sometimes, like in Indonesia, just the time lapse and also just the itinerary, you'd left very early. And the airports in Indonesia, they don't have Western food, so you couldn't really eat very much. So yeah, I did go hungry. But I don't mind sort of missing a meal when I'm traveling, because I always keep some spare. So you're healthy enough. And look, as a monk, you learn how to go without food for 2, 3, 4 days, 5 days, a week at a time. You don't die. A lot of times, you're not hungry in the evening, it's just habit, that's all. And sometimes it's fear as well. Oh, I haven't eaten today, I'm going to die. You don't die if you haven't eaten today. So it's the fear, it's the habit, it's not the hunger, which is the problem. So if you go without food for a day, that's okay, doesn't mind. Perhaps you could give a condensed answer so that all questions could be dealt with. Okay. No. I might be dead before you address my question. I'll probably be hanging around Jhana Grove as a ghost waiting for your answer. You are most welcome to be a ghost here. I invite you to be a ghost, but it costs you, how is it, $25 a day to be a ghost at Jhana Grove? To do a self-retreat? No, you won't. Yes, sometimes that I'd like to answer questions quickly, but you've got to give respect to every question. Somebody, this may be not important to you at all, maybe a silly question, but the person who wrote it is important, and I respect that. Because I've seen teachers, they don't answer any questions, and I think that's really disrespectful. And sometimes they get a good question and they just dismiss it. And I think that's very disrespectful. Because I was one of those people who ask a question when I was a lay Buddhist from a monk. And they just answered in such a way that it wasn't important to them. And that was really disrespectful. That hurt as a lay person. So I would never do that to you. Not on purpose. Retreat statistics, day 4. Number of meditations interrupted by sexual fantasy, 3. Number of fake nimittas, 1. Mine was actually the sun. Number of meditations interrupted by contemplating amusing anecdotes about meditation, 1. Number of times Ajahn Brahm's advice helps me through, every time. That's very nice. That's a really nice question. Ajahn Brahm, what's your view about transference of merits? Can merits be shared? How will we know if the merits received by the departed ones? Sometimes you have dreams of the departed ones. And then actually you can see, they sometimes come to thank you. Thank you for sharing. It happens sometimes. Long times I told this ghost story, the tsunami ghost story. This is the lady over in... in Gribby, and she had a dream one night, this Thai girl, just after the tsunami, of a English girl, young, blonde, came to her in the dream. And basically, this is what happened. You know, in the dream, this ghost came to her, "Help me, help me, I'm dead. I was on Phi Phi Island when the big wave came. I'm dead. And my phone is on the bottom of the sea, and my mother in London's trying to call it right now. Please help me." He said, "I want you to go to Phuket. That's where my body is now, in one of the temples." Gave the name of the temple. "This is where my body is. And can you also organize a Buddhist cremation for me? I want a Buddhist cremation. And tell my mother in London, who's calling me now, not to come until I've cremated. I don't want her to see me like this. I don't want her to remember all bruised and cut and gashed. And here's my mother's telephone number. Let her know what's happened." And then she woke up. Remembered everything, including the telephone number. And she was married to an Englishman. Maybe why the ghost came there. And she woke up her husband, told him everything. And because he was from London, he realized that was a real London telephone number. It was legitimate. So he said, "Well, ring it." You know, she was a tiger. He said, no, you ring." She was really scared. You know, it was a ghost. And it was the middle of the night, or early in the morning in Gribby. And it was, I think, late afternoon or whatever time it was in London. She called the number. A woman answered. And it was this girl's mother. I think the girl gave the name as well in the dream. It was the girl's mother. And the mother, you know, when he said that, you know, "We've just seen your daughter in our dream. She's been killed in the tsunami." The mother wasn't actually shocked, because the mother knew, you know, as a mother would, you know, intuitively, that she knew her daughter was, you know, in Thailand. She knew that her daughter was gone. She could feel that. So it was confirmed. So she gave permission, you know, for the funeral. And she said, "Let me know when it's finished, and I'll come." So the next morning, they went, drove to Phuket Island. It was like 3 or 4 hours from Gribby, and drove there. You know, they got the name of the temple. They went into the temple. It was chaos there after the tsunami. They went into that temple, and she recognized the body, just as she'd seen in a dream. And so, you know, she could identify it. This was the girl's so-and-so. And because they were trying to get rid of as many bodies as quickly as possible, you know, they gave permission for the cremation, you know, with hardly any documentation. So they did the cremation, collected the ashes, and they called the mother, and she came, you know, on a flight from Heathrow to collect the ashes, you know, tearful, embraced, "Thank you so much," and took the ashes back to London. Amazing story. Except what happened next. Da-da-da. When they got back to Gribby, and a few nights later, she had another dream. The same girl. But this time, this actually tells a story. This time, her hair, instead of being all tangled, was perfect. You know, like she'd just been to the hairdressers, about to go to some party or something. Beautiful hair. Clear complexion, just no sort of bruises and cuts anymore. And just dressed in this beautiful white robe. And that's actually how she saw it in the dream. And this girl said, "Thank you. Look what you've done for me. Thank you so much for organizing everything." And said, "I want to thank you. Here's some more numbers." Of course, she remembered them. And they were lottery numbers. And this couple made a fortune. You know, the ghost actually, you know, wanted to say thank you. And what can a ghost do? The ghost knows lottery numbers coming up next week. And they gave the numbers to this girl. And she remembered and wrote them down, bought the ticket the next day, and just cleaned up. That's a really interesting ghost story. And when I tell that story to those people who are scared of ghosts, if a ghost comes into your room tonight, don't be afraid. Don't shoo it out. Ask it for numbers first, and then shoo it out. That's the true story. That's incredible. Just, you know, some of the weird stuff. So, you know, that was a way of helping this ghost, you know, giving merits by doing the funeral service in Thailand, and basically turned him into a deva. And you could see that. You can see the change. He came before and came afterwards and say thank you. So it does work. I know that some lay disciple of you experienced jhana, but how about monk of your monastery? How many of them experienced jhana? Is it because of that that some disrobe? It's actually that if you do, I think it's pretty close the case. If you do experience a jhana, you don't disrobe because you know, you've just got too much happiness. But you know, if maybe you experience a jhana and you lose them, then you may disrobe. But how many experience, who knows? If they haven't yet, they will soon. Are the two events, the happening of jhana and arriving at the true Dharma through attainment of Sotapanna stage, are the two mutually exclusive events? Can one be achieved without the other, i.e. neither is a prerequisite of the other? Thank you very much. Should actually tell this on a talk. Maybe do it tomorrow. What day is it? It's Monday, today, Tuesday? On the arising of insight? Okay, I'll do that tomorrow. Insight and jhanas, and why they go together. Basically, you do need a jhana to get the deep insights. But some people get jhana and don't get the insights. And the classic case of that was Devadatta in the suttas. He got jhanas and psychic powers, but he thought those were attainments. Now, I got the jhanas. And that's why he wanted to sort of take over the Sangha from the Buddha. I know that actually, here's a nice little story. That actually happened when I first became a monk. I went to Wat Pa Phong. It was only about a week or two before I arrived. There was one of the monks there. You know, he got incredible deep meditation, started developing the psychic power of being able to hear conversations at a distance. And he could actually hear conversations in the market, you know, which was about 10 kilometers away. And it was real. They checked it out. What he heard was actually true. Really powerful meditation. But then, what he did, he sat in Ajahn Chah's chair and said, I am enlightened as well. And that was one of the problems there, that, you know, the attainment, the deep meditation and the psychic powers literally sort of, he started to own them and became proud and egocentric. But fortunately, he had a great teacher there, and Ajahn Chah said, look, you know, this is not right, you've gone too far. And he realized that. And the next day, in the dining hall, he bowed to every monk to ask forgiveness, including monks junior to him, because he realized he'd lost it. And then he disappeared and vanished. And he was probably one of those monks who, going off into the jungles and forests by himself, because he had brilliant sort of meditation. Now, he realized one mistake that time, but he probably never made that mistake again. He probably became an arahat later on, because he had so much power in his meditation. But for one day, he lost it, and he became proud. It's so similar to what happened to Devadatta. So you've got to be very careful. If you do get jhanas, please remember the Dharma. It's not an attainment. So letting go, it's not you. In fact, if the you gets involved in there, you lose all the jhanas and all the psychic powers like Devadatta did. So it's a vanishing, a letting go, not an attainment. I have heard that in a sutta called Bhadekarata Sutta, the Buddha mentions about a method of meditation. Could you please explain a little bit about that? Thank you. Then that's a meditation of present moment awareness. No past, no future, just now. So that's in the Bhadekarata. It's a little poem. Forget exactly how it goes, but that's the one place when you say, did the Buddha teach present moment awareness? And that's actually where it is specifically stated. Way before Eckhart Tolle. The Buddha got it first. Can you talk about intuition, including the difference between being compelled to do something and know something versus craving? The intuition, I think that is a different level of knowledge, because you have accumulated experience over such a long time. And instead of thinking about it, you feel it. And all those psychologists doing experiments, even if it's like passing a test at school or university. You read the question, the first answer which comes up, think, oh no, it's intuition. I say, this is the answer. And then you think, no, it can't be. That can't be right. And you know, all the time it's right. Your intuition, that first thought which comes up into your head, is usually accurate. And then thought comes up and you have doubt, and that confuses the whole mind. Intuition is much more powerful. And to know how to do that, I go back to the occasion in Oslo University years ago when somebody asked a question after my talk. I have an important decision to make. How in Buddhism do you make these important decisions in life? And I was very cheeky, and I apologized to her for afterwards, because I said to her, well, let's ground this in sort of a real question. Suppose that you were considering whether you should marry your boyfriend sitting next to you. And she went beetle red, so embarrassed, you know, this, because that's the question she was about to ask. I shouldn't have done that, but, you know, sometimes these things happen. And I said, okay, because, you know, it's what she was contemplating. I hadn't told her boyfriend yet, poor girl. But anyway, I said, the best way to make a decision like that, should I marry him, should I not, is the old tried and tested toss a coin. Heads I marry him, tails I don't. And of course, people say, Ajahn, this is an important decision in life, marrying someone, tossing a coin. You can't do that. And then I explained to her what it means in Buddhism. You get a coin, you toss it. Heads I marry him, tails I don't. So say it comes up heads. Heads I marry him. How do you feel? Do you feel, yes? Or do you feel, two out of three? Because what it's doing there is revealing your intuition to you. You get an answer, and how do you feel about that answer? Come by chance. Do you like the answer, or do you feel, no, that's the wrong answer? And it's that intuition, not whether it's heads or tail, it's how you react and respond to that result. That is what you follow. So if it's heads, I marry him, yes, then marry him. But if it's two out of three, then you don't want to, so don't. It's revealing intuition, getting to know sort of this underlying wisdom, which is a sum total of so many experiences, you know, stored in, you know, what you might call your subconscious. That is far more trustworthy than anything else. Did the Buddha say for us to let praise and blame and the other eight worldly dhammas to not affect us? Praise and blame, fame and dishonor, happiness and suffering. What's the other one? Profit and loss, yes. The eight worldly dhammas. You see just how unworldly I am, profit and loss, I forget that one. Yeah, I know, but we keep losing things. We've got no money in that account. Anyway, but praise makes me feel good, and blame makes me feel horrible. I feel this in my body and mind. The eight worldly dhammas are like a roller coaster I want to get off. How do I? Remember what I said about the lotus? Imagine you're the lotus leaf. Praise is Chanel number 5. And blame is urine, or anything else which is really disgusting. And the thing with the lotus, neither of those liquids sticks to the lotus leaf, and it leaves no residue. The lotus has the same fragrant smell before and after. Now you pour this fragrant, expensive perfume, or this disgusting urine. It's the same afterwards. So you should practice like being a lotus leaf. And if you imagine like that, it's so easy to let go of praise and blame. And then you're not the roller coaster. No praise and blame. Because look, quite frankly, I get praised so many times for things I didn't deserve. And I get blamed for things I didn't do. Is that the same with you? It's with me, anyway. And so I get praised for things I do deserve and blamed for things which I did deserve also. But I also get the opposite as well. So because of that, just let the whole thing go. Then you are not under the control of what other people say. Never allow other people to control your happiness. Because if you really want praise and you really get angry at blame, other people are controlling you. You're not free at all. When you were lotus leaf, you were free. And did you say receiving praise can give us a big head? If so, how does this fit with your other advice? So receiving praise is saying, thank you, I deserve that, only gives us a big heart. Yeah, it does. You know, if you receive praise, it does actually give you a big heart. The thing is that we do the opposite. The best is not to receive praise, not to receive blame, just to be a lotus leaf. You're already good enough. But if you've got a choice between the two, what happens? People receive the blame, but they never receive the praise. Someone says, you slept in Ajahn Brahm's cave. Oh God, yeah, that's true. I feel terrible. I'm hopeless. I'm awful. Blame you receive straight away. But when I say, no, it's a wonderful thing you did sleeping in Ajahn Brahm's cave. You taught that girl outside a lesson in patience, in letting go, in forgiveness and kindness. You did a great service to that person outside, teaching them so many wonderful qualities. You think, no, Ajahn Brahm, you're making it up. Praise you don't receive, blame you always receive. And that's the problem with many human beings. So to balance that, say, okay, receive praise, don't receive the blame. Get to that stage first of receiving praise and not blame. And then go to the next stage of not receiving anything. And is it still okay for me to praise myself, saying, I love me and I'm very important to me, such like? Yeah, sure. Please share the story of Bacon and Egg from your book, Open the Door of Your Heart. In Q&A sessions here, we heard about a father has a mistress and caused so much grief to his family. A man also asked for having a mistress and two other women lock herself up to avoid their husbands. I also see many young men and women here. Perhaps a story about the relationship and commitment may benefit them. This is just people having sexual liaisons and stuff like that. Look, marriage. It's like a pack of cards. Did I tell that story yet? Here? Already told the story. Okay, the other marriage jokes. I remember this guy, and he told me after 30 years of marriage, he still holds his wife's hand. He used to hold his wife's hand when they were courting. He used to hold his wife's hand out of love when they were courting. After 30 years of marriage, he holds his wife's hand still, out of self-defense. I'm a mug, I've got these great marriage jokes. Love is blind. Have you ever heard of love is blind? Love is blind. So marriage is an institution for the blind. Is anyone getting married soon? I did that once. I told a marriage joke to somebody. And they looked at me, stony-faced, and said, I'm going to Bali to get married tomorrow. Oh, God, what have I just said? I really just put my foot in it. I said, I'm sorry, it's only a joke. I think he became a Christian, left Buddhism. So the bacon and egg story, when you're going out with someone, it's called involvement. When you get married, it's called commitment. You're married. You're committing to one person. And when you're involved, you know, going out, maybe you can dump her or go out with somebody else or dump him or whatever, but marriage, committed. And the simile is the difference between involvement and commitment is the difference between bacon and eggs. Because in bacon and eggs, the chicken is involved, but the pig is committed. You know, the pig gives his whole life, 100%. The chicken only gives an egg and walks away. That's like going out together. So if you do get married, remember it's pig stuff. And you know, you know, that story was in the first edition of the Opening the Door of Your Heart book. And you know, it's been published in many other languages. And even in Hebrew. Only that one was taken out. You know, because they've got pig and bacon, and so, you know, they're Jews. And so, can I get another story? So I had to give them another story, because it's crazy. It's only a story and a joke, for goodness sake. But if it mentions pig, you know, even the word pig and pork and stuff, you can't do that in Israel. Anyway. Next question. Ajahn Brahmani once said that you forgot that we have much more defilements than you do. I think there is no possible comparison. Yeah, but if you look at your defilements, then you see more. And I don't look at your defilements, I see the other part of you. When I see that part, then you do too. What you look at in somebody else is what you see in yourself. So look at the beauty in the monks and nuns here, and then you can see that in yourself as well. When you look for the weeds, there's plenty of weeds in there to find. Go look for the flowers, and there's plenty of flowers in there as well. So that's why, you know, I don't look at your defilements. I look at the other qualities. When I see them, then you see them, and then they grow. You come from Brahma's world with a kind heart and pure mind. How do you know? I didn't come from Brahma's world with a kind heart and pure mind. I came from Acton in West London. I didn't have a pure mind. I used to get drunk. I used to do stupid things when I was a kid. I once made a bomb when I was a kid. I could have been a terrorist. But there was no opportunities in those days. Thank goodness. I gave a mug, yeah. But I had a friend, I still remember his name, Christopher Nightingale, and together we got some chemicals, mostly from his brother, and I supplied from the tin can. We made an explosive device, and we set it off in the park, and it worked. It went bang! And I was really proud. I said, wow, that was a really cool thing to do, to get a bomb and it actually worked. I was really so happy, until I got caught. Another big trouble. He was only 10 years of age, messing around. That was really good fun. So, you know, I wasn't that pure. So, we need to work hard on the foundation of virtue before we can be like you. Just sit down, do nothing, become still all by itself, and have mindfulness as a consequence of stillness. Isn't that right, Ajahn? No. That's a trouble. People think that somehow, you know, I was born with a bald head. Yeah, actually I was, apparently. must have been a sign. But I was just an ordinary kid. Actually, I don't know why my brother kept all those photographs when I was a kid, but you can see those books, you know, my birthday book. You know, as a baby. I don't know why he kept that photograph. And, you know, when we were in some holiday cabin making faces at the camera. And that's in that book as well. It's really embarrassing. I'm very scared of my brother coming over. Actually, at the conference we're going to do in August, you've got one of my friends from universities coming over, Bernard Carr. And, you know, that one of the organizers, this is going to be really interesting. You know, he was at university with you. You can find out what you were like at university. And I already emailed him, and I said, listen, Bernard, you're bringing your wife with you. I'll make a deal with you. I won't tell your wife what you did if you won't tell my disciples what I did. And that's our deal. So you're not going to find out. And I remember my poor brother, and I was visiting him once and telling his kids, he's got a son and a daughter, and they're about 10 or 11, 12 years of age. And now just hanging out with them, their uncle. They don't call me uncle. They call me Munkle. Munkle Brown. It's a nice word. So, you know, you're Munkle. And anyway, you know, they were just chatting, you know, just bonding with my nephew and niece. And then we got on to the conversation what, you know, their father did when he was young. You know, when we were sort of teenagers together. And we'd like anyone else got up to all sorts of mischief. And I was telling them what what their dad did. And they went, this is really interesting, because, you know, we get into trouble for doing that. And then he came into the room. He said, what are you talking to my children about? You're undermining all the discipline which I've been telling them all these years. And actually, I said, no, look, brother, you know, it's good you tell you this is right, this is wrong, but it's really nice that they know that their father was a human being and just got into trouble like, you know, they do sometimes. And you can love him even more that way. But my brother was really upset at me. Don't you ever tell all those secrets again. Yeah, anyway, I'm sorry, where am I going? I really enjoy and relax during my retreat here. Didn't think about work, which always stresses me out. But why, when my mind tries to focus to be still, it still keeps searching and wondering? Is it because I try so hard? Yes. It's easier to stop when it's tired because no energy to wonder. Ha ha ha, please enlighten me. Yeah, when you try to focus to be still, you're actually agitating your mind. The trying is shaking your mind. You have to let it be still. Get out the way. Put it down. Relax. Your mind becomes still by itself. But if you try to focus, you actually disturb things. So trying, which is a problem. How many years do you learn meditation until you can realize samadhi? One moment. I learned meditation almost 3 years, and I never see nimitta. My progress is very slow, but I'm so content. That's good enough. Just be content. And then jhana has come to you. How long do you have to sit to get a jhana? Until you're still. You sit under the tree, and when you're still, the mangoes fall into your hand. Actually, it's not just stillness. Opening your hand up, I understood that as compassion, kindness. Opening your heart, being still, those two things together, then the mangoes fall, according to Ajahn Chah, in that brilliant simile of his. How long does it take for you to be still? That's up to you. Every time you move, every time you're impatient, every time you want something to happen, you stop the stillness. You stop it developing. You interfere with it. So all you need to do is to, again, just like that simile of the aircraft of the future. Just the pilot, that's you, and the dog, that's me. You're supposed to feed me like you do every day. And my job is to bite you if you do something. So I should do that more often. If I get in your hand, every time you try and make yourself still, bite. To stop interfering with the process. Then you become still, and then all these things happen to you. Do you recommend past life regressions by hypnosis or other means, other than meditation? Would that be useful for Dharma practice? Yeah, it can be. Especially, can't really tell you who it is. There's one guy, and he got regression therapy. Can't give too many details. He was actually trying it out because his brother was having difficulties. And he thought, before I ask my brother to do this, I'm going to try out for myself. So he went to have regression therapy, worked straight away because he was actually exhausted this day. It's interesting to say that tiredness is very easy to focus. That's true because not so much restless energy. He was really exhausted by doing some navel exercise. But he went there and he got into a past life straight away with all the names, his wife's name, the place he met her in a pub in Fremantle. He was this soldier, special type of soldier, sent by the British to the colonies, 3 years looking after prisoners, and after 3 years of service looking after the convicts, they were given a grant of land, which was down south somewhere, in a town I don't ever heard of, and where he built his own house, had kids, remembered all the kids' names, and then retired to Albany, where he was eventually buried. He knows everything. And he went to the Batty Library, the big history library in Perth, and I just, maybe it's true. Everything turned out to be true. The names. You know, he actually showed me a picture of the deed of title in this place with his old name on it, his wife's name. And the stone house. He went with the hypnotist to see the stone house. And he went to because it was a heritage, it was one of the first stone houses in the area. And the farmer who owned the land took him there and said, "This isn't it. This is not the house. It's in the wrong place. It's up on the hill." And the farmer got very embarrassed. Because there was a house up there, and he destroyed it. He broke the law. You're not supposed to destroy heritage, but it was good pasture. The farmer got busted. So, it's amazing, this sort of thing. But the result of that was this guy, who was, you know, he used to come to our Buddhist society, when he got his past life, and it was real, and he said, "Well, I never really believed in reincarnation before, but now I know it's true, because I can remember everything, and it turns out to be true."